This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 76 was recorded on August 17th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. With gold once again flirting with key technical resistance at $1,300 per ounce, we've been getting a lot of requests to do a gold-centric show. So GoldMoney.com co-founder Josh Crum will be joining me as this week's featured interview guest. Josh and I will discuss everything from the role of gold in a portfolio to his current outlook for gold prices, silver prices, the U.S. dollar, cryptocurrencies, and much more. But be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview, as Patrick and I will be back to discuss those U.S. dollar trading strategies we promised you a couple of weeks ago.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Just for our listeners to make a note, we recorded today's session a little bit early at 2 p.m., so this market wrap is not going to include anything that has happened in the final trading hours of today's session. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 once again has started to sell off again. We see this starting to see that big volatility, the big swings down and up. I was talking with a lot of my members about the importance of the S&P holding like this kind of 2450 pivot, and we've blown right through that on the downside. Is this the beginning of a further downdraft in the market here?
Well, I think it could be. The big test in my mind is going to be 2430, which was the low in reaction, the panic reaction. Oh my gosh, the world is coming to an end, and there's going to be a nuclear war. Of course, that's pretty much blown over. There's, at least for now, not going to be a nuclear war. It seems like Gary Cohn leaving the White House or not leaving the White House, or they can't decide or something. The news flow has been very scattered. That's taken us down here to about 2442 as we're speaking around 2 p.m. That is still just a few points below the 50-day moving average, which is sitting right about 2448. So, you know, it is definitely some weakness, and I think it's very significant because once the North Korea is going to be the end of the world thing blew over, the big question in my mind was, would we make it back to new all-time highs again? We got as far as about 2472, 2473 on S&P futures, and that's as far as we could get. And of course, today's tape action has been dramatically to the downside. So, and the other thing is, this is happening, as far as I can tell, in the Gary Cohn news today. We haven't even gotten to the debt ceiling, Patrick, which I think would be a more substantive reason for the market to really start to roll over here. The thing is, are we talking about just small pullback, which could be a buy-the-dip moment, or are we talking about the beginning of a true bear market? The thing you've got to really keep in mind is that for a true bear market to start now would really require a pretty major deviation from historical norms, and I say that specifically pertaining to retail participation. The normal format of how bull markets end is the last stage is fueled by a dramatic increase in retail participation. That's when you've got people lined up around the corner trying to open their E-Trade account because they don't want to miss out on the stock market. Now, we are seeing that. It has started. We've seen online brokers reporting record new numbers of applications for new accounts, but it's only been in the last couple months or so. So if this market has topped, if we saw at 2488, that was the high print and the bull market starts now, it would probably be a record in terms of how short that last stage that's defined by increasing retail participation has been. Now, that doesn't mean it can't end here, but you know, just keep in mind that usually the way these things end is with more retail participation than we've seen. If we do climb back up and test all-time highs, I'm going to start a accumulating puts. But again, it's a lottery ticket trade. You don't really know. The market is, I think, way ridiculously overvalued. It's been that way for quite a long time. It doesn't mean it can't get more overvalued. What we need to see is the catalyst that turns it all around. I think the debt ceiling is probably the most likely candidate for that. One thing I will tell you, Patrick, is I wish I had bought my puts. sense when Jeff Gundlach did, because although I think we may very well get up to the same number around 2488 in terms of all-time highs, I don't think we're going to get to the same low on the VIX, which defines the cost of buying that optionality. So we'll probably have to move quite a bit higher in order to get the same price on the puts that Jeff Gundlach paid. So I'll keep my fingers crossed and see what happens.
All right, well, let's move on to that dollar index, which has more or less and surprisingly been pinned sort of between that 93 and 94 level for several days now. You know, I thought we would have gotten a little bit more of a reaction off of the FOMC minutes. What's your feeling about the direction of the dollar here?
Well, the big question, obviously, is was that the bottom? Are we about to embark on a retrace where we go back up to the 102 or so level, which is where the previous high had been? I don't know. I'm still watching. Remember that we had two competing views. So far, the Julian Brigden view is winning out. But remember that Juliette de Klerk had predicted that there would be a move up in the dollar, which we've seen. She said that's the opportunity to get short because it's going to come back down. We'll see who's right. I don't really have a strong view here.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, where we had this big draw in inventories, and yet oil slams lower. I was just very curious as to what you were thinking in terms of what's happening here in crude.
I think it's actually the second week in a row that we've had that phenomenon where there was a really, really big drawdown in crude oil inventories nationally, and it did not result in major upside tape action. The thing that was going on is we had seen finally that closing print below 48.50 that I've been waiting for weeks. That's put a lot of bearish sentiment into the market. Then when the inventory number came out, 8.9 million barrel drawdown, obviously that's a huge drawdown, about three times bigger than analyst expectations. But the key, Patrick, is it came in the face of a build on Cushing, Oklahoma inventory of 678,000 barrels, a gasoline inventory build, which was 22,000 barrels, and a distillate build of 702,000 barrels. So we're seeing here in the peak of driving season that finished products are building rather than drawing down, even though there's those very large crude oil drawdowns. The really important number, I think, though, was U.S. production up about 85 basis points to 9.5 million barrels per day in the United States. That may actually be an all-time record, Patrick. I'd have to check, but we're certainly close to it if it's not an all-time record. So there was an up spike, actually, on the 8.9 million barrel drawdown in crude oil inventories. It lasted less than a minute. There was another spike of about 20 minutes later, but eventually we started trading lower, and we saw a big sell-off day on Wednesday. That took us all the way down to the 50-day moving average, right around 46 spot 46 was the low print on the September contract. Remember that most retail platforms will be rolling from September to October in the next couple of days. So if you see a gap in the price, it's probably not a real price gap. It's just a change in the active contract month. We are seeing, though, after bottoming this morning right on the 50-day moving average, a pretty good-looking rebound. So I think we're bouncing off of that key technical level. It's about a 50% retrace of the overall move up that's occurred over the last 6 weeks or so. And I think it's probably got further to go. But, you know, I'm looking for an opportunity to add to my shorts. I think that we're headed below $40 before this is ultimately over. It's just a question of how far this bounce is going to take us and where it's going to create some shorting opportunities. Whether or not we can get back through 48.50 is going to be a key tell, because that was a very significant support level on the way down. Another thing I want to touch on, Patrick, is I think that the Venezuela risk is very misunderstood by the press. People keep focusing on whether or not the U.S. is going to impose oil sanctions on Venezuela. Now, if they did, it would be something like, you know, Venezuelan oil can't be imported to the United States. If that were to happen, Patrick, it would be an absolute nightmare from a logistics standpoint for Texas and Gulf Coast refineries who need that Venezuelan heavy crude as blending stock. It wouldn't really cause that much economic disruption to Venezuela because they could sell the oil someplace else. So that's not really where the big risk is. The big risk is, does the United States intend to force regime change in Venezuela, and could the outbreak of a civil war or something like that result in a security situation that takes Venezuelan production offline completely. Now, if that were to occur, it would be short-lived. It's not in anybody's economic interest to keep Venezuela offline. But you can easily imagine if society is collapsing, and believe me, they're very close to that in Venezuela, if that were to take oil production completely offline, that would make a significant dent in global supply. So I think that that risk is misunderstood a little bit. The shorts, again, have been squeezed out of this market. We're very long, top-heavy in terms of how much net length exists in speculative positions. And the other final thing I wanted to mention, I brought this up last week, is Saudi Arabia supposedly targeting the back end of the curve, which was a headline that came out a couple of weeks ago. I think what's really going on here, Saudi Arabia knows perfectly well that their primary opportunity to influence oil prices is in the spot price and the front month price. I think what's going on is they very much want to see backwardation form in the curve because it injures the ability of U.S. shale operators to finance their projects. So I think that when Khalid Al-Fali said supposedly Goldman Sachs and a bunch of hedge funds were advising him to target the back end of the curve, I think what he was trying to do was play the speculators, get them to try to front run that activity, even though there's probably nothing behind it. And that front running, it did indeed result in some backwardation forming, although it's now subsequently, with this down move, come back out of the curve. That led to articles, one of them just coming out today from John Kemp at Reuters, talking about how backwardation tends to be a sign of balancing, and that means that we could be heading towards much higher prices. Yeah, that is historically what it means, but we've seen backwardation come into the market briefly at each cyclical top, and on this most recent cyclical top, and it was a cyclical top, we've seen enough downside now to prove that it is rolling over, right on the cyclical top, as if by rehearsal, the Saudi Arabian oil minister comes out and starts jawboning why people might want to front run that spread trade that puts the market into backwardation. So I think it was a very effective jawboning act on the part of Khalid Al-Fali, and I don't think it really has a fundamental signal the way most people are interpreting it in the market. I think that that backwardation is going to come back out, and as this market rolls over, although we're bouncing right now, when we eventually roll over and take out $40 to the downside, I think you're going to see plenty of contango back in this market.
All right, now I want to move on to gold here. Now, gold had that little dip that basically had a drop down to about the 1270 level, but already we find ourselves once again heading right up to the top end of its range from the last few weeks. You know, it's going to be very interesting to see whether gold can actually break out above the 1300 level with big upside push. What's your thinking here on gold?
Well, we're on the same page, Patrick, and I should mention, although most of our interview today will be entirely on the subject of gold, it was recorded on Wednesday, a day earlier than we're recording right now. That was before this latest move up in the gold chart. And I think it's very significant because, look, as I said last week, okay, you came back up to 1300, which is pretty much the resistance level that has not been broken for several months now. Well, it happened on the back of, you know, the President of the United States talking about fire and fury and nuclear war and so forth. It's no surprise that gold tested its resistance level on that kind of talk. The point is, North Korea pretty much blew over, gold sold off, but then gold traded back up, and it's now again flirting with that key level. So I'm watching it very carefully. A breakout above 1300 definitely would be a very bullish indication. We're back into that almost there condition even after North Korea. I'll leave it there and save the rest for Josh, but please remember that when we taped that interview with Josh, we were still trading around 1275, and it seemed like gold was selling off in reaction to North Korea blowing over. The sudden move back to the upside didn't occur until after that interview had been taped.
All right. And the final thing I wanted to just touch on is the 10-year Treasury yields. They seem to be so resilient, now hovering around this 2.20%. But it seems like every time it looks like we're about to get a pop in yields, they come right back down. It's like there's a solid bond accumulation going on. What's your feeling here on Treasury bonds?
Well, we are easing down a little bit to 2.20 on the 10-year yield. As you say, that's 4 or 5 basis points lower than last week. But, you know, look at the sell-off that we've seen today. I think that there's money coming out of the stock market that's finding its way into equities. And as we're speaking right now, it looks like the stock market sell-off is even accelerating in below 2440. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see some more weakness there. I think, though, that it's hard to really decide what that means if it's occurring at the same time that the market is selling off as hard as it is today.
Well, thanks for the market wrap, Eric. Now, I'd like to thank all of our listeners that have donated to help us defray our production costs. We have received several $100 donations this week alone. We really appreciate it because it helps us bring you quality programming every single week. If you would like to donate, please click on the donate button on the homepage of macrovoices.com. Joining us as this week's featured interview guest is Josh Crum, co-founder of goldmoney.com. Eric's interview with Josh is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Gold Money co-founder Josh Crum. And Josh, I'd really like to get into gold in this interview because we've seen so much tape action lately that really has a lot of gold bulls excited. Before we do that, though, you know, something I find is everybody in the gold market has a different idea about what gold is, why you have it in the portfolio, and what you're trying to accomplish from an investment strategy. You know, some people would tell you that it's a store of value. Some people would say it's a hedge against financial market collapse. The gold bugs would tell you that as soon as the evil cabal of central bankers is done with their manipulation scheme, it's going to $400,000 an ounce overnight, and they're going to get rich. What is gold? Is it a get-rich asset, or is it a stay-rich asset? And how do you use it or see it fitting into a portfolio?
That sounds good. Thanks, Eric. Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably the best place to start because, you know, we seem to have, I'd call it at least two bookends of the view of what gold is. You know, so I, you know, in my background, I actually worked at Goldman Sachs on a macro team and, you know, looked at commodity markets, including gold. And what we looked at was really, like most of Wall Street, in a supply and demand model, you know, much like you look at copper or oil. You know, I had different drivers, but essentially people were looking at it for year over year change in supply and year over year change in demand and the level of inventories. So this is a very, very standard model. But the problem is with that sort of linear model is you look at it of what's the demand for, say, jewelry or for coins or ETF flows. And so you look at it, but the problem is you have almost all of history's gold sitting there in inventory, you know, roughly $7 trillion worth of gold as a commodity stock, or as I would view it as a money stock, which makes it very different than, you know, carrying, you know, 30 days of inventory of oil or 60 days of aluminum. So it's a very different market. And people really in the guts of commodity markets, they understand that inventories and spreads drives prices. But then on the other side of the spectrum, you have this view that, you know, that the dollar is completely worthless, you know, backed up by nothing, created out of thin air. And although there's aspects of that I'd probably tend to lean towards with the extraordinary policies in central banking, that's also not fully true because, you know, there's a lot of assets backed up dollars. So anyways, where I'm going with this is I think it's important to look at gold's, you know, kind of remove the economic lens and even remove the financial lens for a second and just kind of look at gold and commodities in nature. What is it that the math of gold shows us over time? Sort of remind, you know, without any models, without any theories, if you look at the data, you see that the production cost, the cost of mining gold relative to the cost of mining copper or the cost of producing wheat or all of these different commodities stays very, very proportional over very, very long periods of time. And so they have this anchored, you know, sort of relative cost function based in scarcity. So regardless of what your sort of model is, you know, how should we analyze gold? How should we look at gold from a theoretical standpoint? We see that the data shows that gold has this very tight long-term correlation with all other commodities. And so that is where the most important thing for me looking at it is that proves that gold is a store of value relative to the things that are essential for humans, eating, energy. And so by one definition, the market shows that gold is a store of value. No matter what, our job is to then figure out why next. but the math and the history of gold shows that gold is a store of value for that function.
Okay, well, I've heard a lot of different views about different people modeling gold in different ways, and some see it as a commodity, some see it as a form of money, as actually currency. You've got a view, though, about energy defining the value of gold, and I think of also some other commodities. That's a new one on me. I haven't heard that from other analysts. Can you explain where energy comes into this equation?
Sure, absolutely. So I think the most important thing from a mathematical or cost of production perspective is all of these base commodities, which are essentially just either elements or compounds, either found in nature or very close, taking something in nature and refining it to a product that we consume. So what's known as the natural resource commodities, just looking at the cost or the replacement cost. So this is sort of a what I like to call an energy theory of value. So the energy basis of all of these different commodities, again, whether it's grains or whether it's copper, aluminum, gold, that they're going to have a proportion of their cost that's purely just energy cost. It really has very little to do with labor. It's more about if you pull a gram of gold out of a ton of rock, there's a very high, commodity energy component to crush it, grind it, refine it. And that will always be very high proportion to the cost. Unlike a service, a pure service economy good, which has a very high proportion of labor. I like to anchor everything in its energy cost and its labor cost. But the labor cost itself, of course, if you think about labor, you move from, very commodity labor, which is essentially, paying a living wage that is, energy-based goods, to very highly specialized service economies. So, even that can even be broken down further into energy. But this is important for what I call the anchor or that sort of the energy theory of value for both money, for goods, for anything in the economy. It can be anchored by its relative energy cost. But then the cyclical side of things, the price volatility, the price elasticity, really comes from the short-term supply and demand for any of these things. Again, whether it's copper and you look at the futures curve and it's very based in its replacement cost and energy and it moves very well correlated with the oil price. But the price you see on the ticker every day is typically the front month price or the 3 month price in copper, for instance, and that can be very volatile based on short term supply and demand, inventories. But most things are generally anchored in the future based on their energy replacement cost.
I see where energy plays a role in the increasing cost over time because of increasing scarcity. Hundreds of years ago, if you wanted gold, you could go wading in a riverbed someplace and reach down and pick up gold nuggets. These days, we have to get tons and tons of rock and crush it with expensive machinery just to get a gram of gold out of it. Presumably, as that trend continues and it becomes more and more scarce, that production cost goes up and therefore the value goes up over time. So I see where the energy comes into the equation from the cost of mining and producing gold. But gold is not a battery technology. You can't run your Tesla on, gold nuggets or something. So where do you see the role of energy in determining the value of something after it's already been produced? Or am I missing the point completely?
No. I that's actually a great question. And I think this is probably the one that most confuses people. And I agree. It's not a battery in that you can put energy in and then, take it back as consumable energy. However, it's a monetary energy. It's something that can last forever. But before I get to that for a second, all of these other goods and services that can be, again, on a scarcity basis, you define that well, on a scarcity basis, that they all have the same energy, relative abundance and shortages create more energy cost for one good versus another. But the carry of all of these things. So that kind of anchors them. But if you produce, you know, wheat, you've got to store it. You've got to dry it. You've got, you know, it's got a very high energy carry versus gold, which once you produce it, it lasts forever. There's no decay. And of course, a barrel of oil, once you produce it, you know, the carry on oil is very high. You know, putting it in a tanker, or, you know, turning over inventory in a salt dome, or all of these different things, because it doesn't last forever. So there's the energy cost, but there's also the energy carry, which is very important for, you know, choosing one good as a store of value versus the other. So if you look at all of the elements, you know, gold is one of the rarest. So that's what creates a very high cost structure, but it also lasts forever, which creates the very low carry. And this is why it became very good money, not because you consumed money, but because you could anchor and measure everything else versus it. And if you look at the things that gold are used for today, you look at jewelry. Why does it matter to have gold jewelry? Because everything else corrodes, rusts, breaks, goes away. Gold jewelry lasts forever. If you look at all of the different things found in the Titanic, it's the gold 22 or 24 karat gold lockets that are in literally perfect condition. Everything else has gone away. So gold becomes this arbiter of time, which is what money should be. So sorry, maybe I took that a little too complex, but I think it's very important to understand that energy cost versus energy carry.
Now, critics of gold, of course, are famous for saying that gold produces no income. You've got an asset that has no positive carry because it doesn't generate any revenue. That essentially leads us to the conclusion that really the real interest rate has to be the driver of value. If you've got negative real interest rates in the economy, then you do actually have a return on holding gold, just as a positive carry cost. As long as there's a positive real interest rates, and of course real interest rates, by which we mean the interest rate adjusted for inflation, if you've got positive real interest rates, then other things become more attractive than gold because they can produce that positive real return. As we get to what a lot of people are predicting is, you know, whether it happens this year or next year or the year after that, someday Jeff Gundlach's going to be right. The 35-year bond bull market is going to be over. We'll be heading at least in nominal terms to much higher interest rates, and that would seem on the surface to paint a very bearish picture for gold. Would you agree with that, or do you think that those rates are only going to come in a high inflation environment where actually will be still negative in terms of real rates?
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, going back to the very first thing you said, you know, where gold doesn't have a use and doesn't pay interest. Well, neither does a bearer asset as a U.S. dollar bill. You know, the $1 or $100 bill in your pocket also carries no interest. What carries interest is taking financial system risk. That's depositing the money, and there's a counterparty risk. So there's part of that is part of the interest rate on a dollar. And then the other part of it, what is the collateral of the banking system backing up the creation of those new dollars? And so, you know, if there's a real yield in the economy, then yes, that, you know, the dollar can appreciate beyond even the counterparty risk in your bank account when there's real growth coming into the dollar economy, backing up the dollar financial system. When there isn't real growth, or there's inflation because the dollars need to be created to support themselves and create the effects of growth versus actual underlying real economy growth, then you're going to have negative real rates even if you have higher nominal rates. On your question about what happens when, you know, rates start rising or bond yields start rising, again, we always have to look at in real terms, not in nominal terms. In real terms, and I'll go back to that commodity analogy, I know with pretty good certainty, you know, with a 2 to 5,000 year time series that gold is going to, you know, holding my gold will buy me the same amount of meals in really any currency, any political regime, anywhere in the world, in any time. Gold's going to be able to buy me a similar amount of apples, going to buy me a similar amount of grains or energy. So that's the store of value function that we know about gold, you know, being money, even if it doesn't produce income. What we don't know is, even if nominal yields go up, in 10 years time, that euro bond with that coupon is going to buy me the same amount of apples, the same amount of energy. And I would say the probability of that is close to zero. You know, say you're not getting paid any duration risk. You're not getting paid any sovereign risk. You're not getting paid any credit risk at the end of 10 years holding, you know, most euro denominated bonds, either corporates or government. You have almost no coupon and maybe you get your euro denominated principal back. So I'm not worried that nominal yields are going to go up or people are going to get paid more for risk and somehow that's going to decrease, you know, gold store of value function. Unless there's real growth and real interest rates in the economy, again, that's kind of another part of the question.
Now, as you know, gold has been a very effective store of value and has proven itself for more than 10,000 years. I happen to share that view myself personally. But my job here to put my journalist hat on is to kind of play the devil's advocate. So let's look at the other side of that argument, which is if we had a really big cryptocurrency buff here, he'd say, Josh, look, you know, gold's been a store of value for 10,000 years. For most of those 10,000 years, we had bloodletting and, you know, all kinds of primitive things that we don't do anymore. Gold is shiny yellow metal. It doesn't have a lot of utility value. I mean, sure, it's useful in jewelry. It looks pretty on girls. But aside from that, it doesn't really do much other than electrical contact. And although it's true that it's been a store of value, there's a much better store of value because what cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin have done is they have mathematically modeled the same scarcity properties that you have in gold. You know, the first Bitcoins didn't require a lot of computing cycles to mine. As you get more and more, just like gold, it gets more and more expensive, but now it's not energy in terms of mining equipment. It's, you know, compute power energy. And that doesn't screw up the environment. Let's face it, the mining industry is not terribly friendly to the environment. So Bitcoin's the new thing, baby. Forget about gold. Go with cryptocurrency. That's going to replace it. Nobody's ever going to want gold again. It's going to be an ancient relic because it's replaced by something better that does the same thing. What would you say to that argument?
That argument breaks down on a number of points. First off, I'm not necessarily anti-Bitcoin. I think it has medium exchange properties and it has scarcity properties through, as you mentioned, the proof of work and mining. It's a very, very interesting model for the internet that you can use the internet rails and the internet protocols to transfer value, but with a scarce asset that can't be digitally replicated and copied, you know, the double spend problem. So first off, I think the medium of exchange function of Bitcoin is very, very interesting. However, its store of value function, it could be an investment, you know, speculation that takes it from, you know, the cryptocurrencies right now, roughly 150 billion market cap. Gold is 7 trillion. So relative to other securities and risk assets, can that 150 billion, you know, go up on in, you know, call it a bubble, call it, you know, more allocation? Sure. So is that a better store of value? No, it's just a risk, you know, it's a risk in liquidity, you know, sort of market share gain. Is it a better store of value? Absolutely not, because there's no scarcity in these protocols. This is a mathematical, you know, this is a mathematical function that can be replicated, and we've already seen it replicated with obviously a different protocol, but Ethereum, other supply of cryptocurrencies, even Bitcoin and Cash itself, you know, essentially spun out another asset from its own, you know, original blockchain. So, you know, from a store of value perspective, absolutely not. Until cryptocurrency has, you know, a covalent bond structure like the element AU, you know, it doesn't have natural, you know, atoms scarcity. It may have bits scarcity, but it doesn't have atom scarcity. And so it will never replace that function of being able to, and if you look at over billions of people, you know, I would say the use of gold and the trusted element of gold being a store of value. You know, we live in this sort of financial bubble, this very, you know, sort of Western elite, you know, 1% bubble of the world, but there's still billions of people that don't trust their governments and don't trust their banking systems. And their demand for a store of value is not adornment and jewelry. It's being able to hold savings in something that lasts. And that's not going away anytime soon. So it's not zero sum, and Bitcoin will never be replacing gold from a elemental store of value.
I want to hit you with another risk that I see that arises from cryptocurrency, but in a very different way. And that is that I think that the threat to Bitcoin is that eventually we'll see government-backed and owned cryptocurrency. People's Bank of China is already working on something right now. And we'll get to a point where governments outlaw private cryptocurrencies. They'll announce that, you know, nobody other than terrorists or people that are trying to finance terrorists has any reason to want Bitcoin. And, you know, the new currency is the, we'll call it the Orwell, the new unit of cryptocurrency that's created by the government, and it's fully traceable and can be taxed and has all kinds of attributes that are just the opposite of what Bitcoin does. Now, if that were to happen, I suppose you could make two arguments. One is it's looking fantastic for gold initially, because gold would be your obvious go-to as a store of value if you don't want to be in that government-controlled cryptocurrency system. But if they're going to outlaw Bitcoin, they might outlaw gold next. And if gold were outlawed, to the which has happened before, you know, private people in the United States were not allowed to own gold for many decades. If we saw that again, and the market for gold was just the consumers in electronic context, you know, if the whole gold bug market is gone, then that's got to not be looking good. So, do you see any of those things as risks for gold?
No, not at all. So first on the, you know, government backed, call it cryptocurrency. So I think they're kind of complete opposites. So if you attempted to have a, you know, let's call it the Canadian dollar, the CAD coin, you know, what they'd be creating is a bearer asset on a blockchain, which means the person in digital control of this, you know, is the bearer of that. It's not bank system money. It's not generating interest. It's just a Canadian dollar coin. Now, why would anyone, first off, want that, you know, for the risks of it being hacked? And why would the government want that, you know, particularly when the trend is towards bringing more assets into the banking system, being able to have more control? You know, next time there's a recession, you know, they want more infrastructure to take interest rates negative, which means less bearer assets, less cash. So I just don't see them one wanting it, and I don't see the market wanting it either. You know, the value of Bitcoin is its anti-sovereignty properties. It's a bearer asset that can transcend any sovereign boundaries, unlike financial bank system money. So what I mean is, you know, it doesn't have to be black market activity. That's obviously one of them, but capital controls. You know, a big wave of people buying Bitcoin now from an institutional perspective is they look at it and say, you know, look, I think there's going to be more capital controls put into place, whether it's through the next recession or things that are happening in China, banking system risks. So they want to own cryptocurrency as something that can easily, you know, sort of get out of the banking system and still transact and still move across borders. You know, so those properties that people want Bitcoin to begin with are completely opposite of wanting a CAD coin or any other currency. I'm just not worried about that. As far as the gold, again, losing market share, this is something that's quite important to understand in gold as a money stock or commodity inventory versus a, you know, short-term supply and demand. So, you know, roughly $150 billion worth of gold produced, you know, new gold produced and consumed in the market this year. Now, if demand fell by 20% on a unit basis, that still is insignificant to the, you know, $7 trillion worth of inventory in the world. So again, this incremental market share gain by cryptocurrencies or Canadian dollar coins or whatever else, it's got to be relative to that $7 trillion number for it to matter. It's not the year-over-year supply and demand. And I guess the final point on outlying gold, I don't see it, because, you know, the first time that these things happened, you know, gold was part of the government monetary system. It was part of their mandated system. Now it's a money stock. It's a completely private money stock for the most part. I mean, obviously there's still some sovereign gold, but for the most part, it's a private money stock and a commodity of element that it'd be arbitrary. You know, we're going to ban gold and we're going to ban you owning trees and we're going to ban you owning, you know, apple orchards. I don't know. I mean, so could it get to that? Sure. But is gold at any more risk? And would that drive the price down or up? You know, clearly it would drive the price up, not down.
I want to get to your outlook for gold and silver and so forth. But before we go there, I think we need to touch on the U.S. dollar, because, of course, if gold is priced in dollars, until we know the direction of the dollar, we can't make too much sense out of the direction of gold. So what do you see for the U.S. dollar? We've heard some guests on the program say they think that this rout in the dollar index is over. It's all uphill from here for the dollar. We've had other guests say, no, this is a bounce and we're headed lower, and the euro in particular, they think will be stronger. What do you see for the U.S. dollar as well as the Canadian dollar?
Yeah, so this also goes back to the framework of understanding what's actually moving. The problem in these currencies is they're not really anchored to anything. So, you know, while it looks like the dollar is going down, is it because the dollar is going down or is it because the euro is going up? You know, what is the dollar going down in relation to? Is it going down in relationship to all other goods in the economy? Well, that would be called inflation. And we see fairly stable inflation numbers. And you know, let's even look outside, you know, the euro. Let's look at emerging market currencies. Is the dollar going down the last, you know, it's 10% draw? Was that against emerging market currencies? Well, not really. It was mostly just the euro and some other G10 currencies, Canadian dollar and so forth. And if you look at it versus gold has also been in a very tight range, you know, some of the lowest volatility in decades. And so the US dollar, I would argue, is not going down. The dollar index may be going down because it's so heavily weighted to the euro, but that's really just the euro going up. And on that note, looking back of why the euro is going up and whether that's going to continue, I think that's another interesting debate, because if you look at the fundamentals, sure, there's been a little bit of upside surprise in economic data, you know, not great, you know, inflation data, slightly better. The big driver of the rally of the euro is because there's this rotating system of funding currencies and carry trade. So if you look at this new monetary regime we're in, where everyone wants a weaker currency and wants to lower interest rates to produce growth, we're sort of just cycling around the world of different currencies having their turn at devaluing and creating lower, you know, lower real interest rates to try to stimulate growth. And the biggest ones, you know, obviously Japan has been one for, you know, decades, but the Europe became the carry currency. And that has unwound with slightly better economic data and probably slightly less political pressure from the extreme right groups and so forth. So I would argue that the dollar actually hasn't been going down. It's just the euro going up on a relative basis. But over the longer term, we know mathematically and through the policies that guide all of these currencies that they trend to zero. Always has been, always will. That's just the logic that sort of, you know, like the Bitcoin has its protocol. The protocol of New Keynesian central banking is to drive the value of zero, the currency to zero over time.
Let's move on then to the outlook for gold prices. We've seen gold really since about March or so, kind of range bound here between about 1210 and not quite 1300. Looks like 1297 or so is the high that we've tested three times now over the last several months, and it was rejected again just a couple weeks ago, at least so far. Where do you see things going? We're going to stay range bound? Are we moving higher? Was this latest test just about the escalation of North Korea, or is there more going on in this picture?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And again, if you look at those fundamentals, I would look at the gold price as the numerator and the currency as the denominator. So what drives the value, the relative value of the dollar, not against the euro, but just against gold, is real interest rate outlooks. And if you look at, you know, what the TIPS market has been saying, for instance, it's very similar to what I was just saying about currencies. The dollar actually has not changed much over the last three quarters. You know, there was obviously the volatility around the Trump election, but after that kind of settled in, TIPS yields have been very range bound, just like gold has. So that's the sort of denominator side. So there's fundamentally not much happening in the denominator of gold divided by US dollars. Now, looking at the numerator and what, again, that anchor value of gold, then you have to sort of start looking at the energy market. So you look at what is happening on, you know, globally from energy markets that could drive, you know, increased scarcity for energy, increased cost for gold. And that has also been actually very range bound. Now, the front end of the oil curve is moving, you know, up and down in this range of sort of, you know, call it $45 to $55. But if you look at the whole curve and you look at the futures price of oil, it's been extremely low, low volatility, sort of sitting around, you know, $53 to $55. So again, you've got TIPS yields extremely range bound. You've got long-dated energy extremely range bound. And that's created gold being very range bound, regardless of the sort of the unwinding of QE in Europe, or you know, the supposed, you know, positioning for unwinding of QE in Europe. So I think a lot that's happened is more Europe centered and not gold centered and not dollar centered or not energy centered. That's where we've got this fundamental low volatility. Part of it is central banks just buying up all assets globally that suppressed volatility. but also just like true fundamental macroeconomic volatility has been extremely low. So that's what's kept gold range bound. Now, looking out over a quarter, over a year, you know, I continue to think over the next quarter, you know, unless you have some real shocks in central banking policy coming out of, you know, the Jackson Fed conference or in September, I actually think gold will continue to be in this range. But looking at it more from a long-term perspective, I think this is an accumulation phase, because if you look at those, you know, if you look at the real interest rate portion of the dollar, I don't believe we have much upside in that. You know, I think this recovery is very long in the tooth. You know, we've kind of got all the returns on, you know, leveraged, you know, buybacks that we can get, you know, and it's a lot of things that were driving wealth effects. So that's kind of getting long on the tooth from a real interest rate perspective. And then from an energy basis, yes, I think energy prices will stay pretty stable for the next couple of years, but they're not going to drop significantly. You know, we're not going to go down to a regime where we're producing oil at $35. So I think that gold is pretty anchored at sort of a low level. And if you look out over time, your asymmetry is much more to the upside with falling real interest rates and increasing energy prices. I still think that people need to be allocating more and more gold to their portfolio. And of course, all of the black swans or completely exogenous risks, you know, which is the latest one that drove gold with North Korea. So I think that those are always going to be, you know, gold to the upside. So I think the asymmetry of gold is you've got to own it, and you should own it now while it's boring, and avoid the rush later.
What would you say, though, to, you know, a lot of people think that the stock market is overvalued and due, whether it's this week, next month, or next year, at some point, you know, we've been going straight up since 2009. Let's suppose that there is a big downside correction or even a bear market in the stock market. Now, there's a logical argument that says gold should go up on that, but what we know from the 2008 experience is people tend, when everything is falling apart at the seams, to be selling everything in unison, regardless of the logic involved. So do you think gold is vulnerable to substantial downside if there's a stock market crash, or do you think it actually benefits from it?
I actually don't think it would fall at all. So we wrote a piece on this. You know, this is not 2008, you know, at least not for gold. And I think there was a couple things happening. When gold sold off, and that was just the very initial phase before it bounced, obviously much, much higher. And so, you know, lower dip and much higher recovery than any other asset class, particularly for those first 3 years. I think what happened is, again, that energy component. So the global real economy demand was also collapsing. So your replacement cost for gold. So I don't think this was all just this rush to the dollar as a safety. I think if you look at our fundamental framework, it still performed extremely well. Our model, you know, captured all the movements and the components very well without any major anomalies. And so I actually don't see this. I think it's more of an anecdote than a reality. You know, this demand for dollars drives, you know, gold prices down. Now, if there's some reason, you know, macroeconomically, why real interest rates swing big time in those events, then that can change the value of the dollar fundamentally up or down. But I don't see it as this dumping gold scenario to raise liquidity. Gold is the ultimate liquidity and will continue to be so.
Two quick asides before we move on, Josh. Silver, we haven't mentioned yet. Please give a view there. The other one is, I know you follow Bitcoin. So when we talk about buying Bitcoins this week for upwards of $4,000 each, is that like buying tulip bulbs? Is this a crazy parabolic blow-off top that's all about to fall apart? Or is this thing just getting started?
Yeah, so I'll take the easy one first and go with silver. I actually haven't, you know, personally owned silver since, you know, 2004, 2005, and starting to look at it again. Silver is very interesting relative to gold in two regards. You know, one is because it's lower priced and has more industrial uses, sort of the rolling inventories or the money stock of silver is much, much smaller. So it's prone to squeezes when industrial production picks up and so forth. So that's on kind of the demand side. But on the supply side, what's really interesting is it's got this very discontinuous cost curve where if you're getting silver from a copper mine or a gold mine or as a byproduct, it usually can feed that industrial market. Where it shifts up to being a monetary asset, it can make very big moves. So when real interest rates dip below zero and, you know, the carry on silver, which is probably 30 basis points a year, is less than the real interest, you know, when real interest rates drop below 30 basis points, silver can really pick up and move from the, you know, byproduct part of the cost curve to the primary deposit part of the cost curve, which is a much higher level. So I actually think silver has been incredibly cheap relative to gold over the last, you know, the last couple of years since gold sort of renewed an uptrend. Silver has not, to the most part, because gold's uptrend has fallen in the real interest rate band of sort of 50 basis points. But when real interest rates really start dipping next time, next recession, next bailout, silver is probably going to have a lot more leverage. So I think silver is very interesting here. As far as Bitcoin, this is in pure speculation mode. Now, whether you like the fundamentals or not, I like some fundamentals of the medium exchange and in the, you know, call it the medium term. I don't think it's a long-term store of value, but I do think it has some interesting fundamentals, particularly for the world and the war on cash and all of the things that are coming, sort of next recession. I think Bitcoin, is only going to pick up in demand. So I actually am somewhat bullish, structurally on Bitcoin. But this is certainly extremely volatile, a lot of manipulation, a lot of broken pieces of market infrastructure. It's not for the faint of heart. So it's probably going to go up, in my opinion. You know, I wouldn't bet anything, you know, so significantly on it. As far as the other cryptocurrencies, I mean, there's some extremely dangerous parts of the market, you know, some real scams. You know, I think parts of the Ethereum protocol and a lot of things that happen there is going to end in tears. I think it's going to get very ugly. So I'd be very cautious. But, you know, I think Bitcoin got an interesting time ahead.
Let's come back to gold, because I want to talk about ways to own gold, something that's very difficult with gold compared to other financial assets. If your motivation for wanting the gold in the first place is to have some kind of insulation from the financial system, then, you know, just having golds in some kind of account that's owed to you by a bank doesn't really accomplish anything. I remember a few years ago, there were some private bankers for a certain organization. I would never mention the name of this banking corporation that has offices in Hong Kong and Shanghai on the air. But they were telling their private banking clients that they were doing them this big favor by not charging them any storage fees for their bullion that they were holding, because these people thought that they were keeping allocated bullion out of the system. And in reality, they had unallocated bullion accounts, which means that the bank owed them as an unsecured creditor gold that they didn't have. So please explain allocated versus unallocated accounts for anybody who may not be familiar with that before we go on to some of the other ways that you can hold gold as a financial asset.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. That's actually an extremely important point. And it's not just retail investors. I was actually at another very major investment bank. We won't name names. They use a third-party bullion bank for their unallocated books for what they're doing in client trades. And even they didn't know what their bullion bank had allocated versus just being pure credit and counterparty risk. So absolutely, you know, and we run it into mining companies as well. You know, we're starting to onboard mining companies onto our platform. And they say, oh, well, can't we hold it unallocated like we do with some of the refiners and some of the banks so we don't, you know, have any storage and insurance charge? I'm like, yeah, but, you know, do you really want to swap 10 basis points of storage and insurance for, you know, unlimited counterparty risk when you actually need that bullion or want that bullion? So unallocated is like you said, it's a credit to that financial institution that they've got to deliver on demand when you want the physical gold. And if it's not there, it's going to be very hard to deliver when you actually need it. And then I guess taking that to the next step is the ETFs. Now, the ETFs, for the most part, have the similar problem, but compounded, because they're also a security. So not only is a lot of their underlying, you know, unallocated accounts at these bullion banks, you know, yes, there's physical gold, but they also consider physical gold unallocated accounts at bullion banks. And so again, when you actually want that gold for its tail risk properties and its, you know, its counterparty free nature, then that's not what you're buying. But on top of that, it's a security. It's not, you know, your contract is for rights of a trust. It's not for the actual gold, even unsecured. And for the privilege of having a higher risk product, you're actually getting charged, you know, anywhere from 40 to 50 basis points a year in storage and management of the security, which is about 4 or 5x the actual cost of storing gold. You're actually paying to take more risk. So that's one of the reasons why our company, Gold Money, was actually founded. Was we just saw there was a better way to use the internet and create liquidity in a marketplace, but for underlying physical vaulted gold that's, you know, audited and insured and audited by third parties, which is not what you're getting from a lot of wealth managers, from bullion banks, or from the ETFs especially.
Now, let's just explain what Gold Money is for our listeners who may not be familiar with it. The idea is essentially it's a bank account that's denominated in gold, not in any currency. So what you own is some number of ounces or fractions of ounces. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yes. So you know, as I described before, if I want to, and not only that, we can make it more accessible to buy a fraction. So I can buy, you know, $35 a month of gold and not have to pay $1,200-$1,300 for a coin in a small denomination. Again, similar to the ETF, it's a way to be able to, you know, buy fractional ownership, but your ownership is always secured by fully reserved physical metal. So you always have title, you know, no matter what happens to gold money, you know, you end up having ownership in a physical bar of gold at some of the, you know, the top Brinks at Brinks and some of the top vaulting companies in the world, or at some of the mints that we have on our platform as well.
Now, I really want to dwell on that point because I think it's a very important one. You just said if I have a gold money account, I own the gold. And I just want to make sure we're clear on that. I own the gold, or you own the gold and I'm a creditor and you owe me the value of that gold? How is it possible if one gold bar that you've got in a vault someplace is actually shared by me and a bunch of other depositors? And I love that idea. That's great. I mean, who could possibly go before a court and say, look, there's this gold bar that's in a vault that these gold money guys got stored. I own 1/73 of that bar, so I'd like to come in with my X-Acto knife and, you know, cut a chunk off, Your Honor. Please give me a court order to do so. That doesn't make any sense. So how is it that I can own something when the physical thing that I own is really owned by other people as well?
The important thing about gold is it is a pure element and infinitely divisible. So in the worst case scenario, and people really wanted to just, you know, literally go to the 0.01 grams, you know, we can refine and cut that purity. So yes, your title is all, you know, the client accounts are always fully reserved. So when you buy gold on our platform, it'll say pending until our custodian and our, you know, sort of a clearing agent, the vaults say, yes, this bar with this number is here. That means this, you know, this bar now can back up these orders. And so you actually are settled to a physical bar of gold that you own title to. It's not our operating company. It's a full, you know, client account, and the clients own the physical gold. So we put a lot of thought into this. This was a whole legal and sort of settlement architecture that also, you know, very much like the blockchain, had these principles of third party auditing. And so you didn't have these conflicts of interest. You know, we don't own the vaults. We're not the ones auditing the vaults. These are third parties to ensure that you own titled metal in your account. And no one else was doing this before Gold Money invented this process.
And then the really cool kind of fintech twist to this is a Gold Money account comes with a debit card where I can go to any MasterCard and Visa merchant and, you know, buy myself a new raincoat, or go to an ATM anywhere in the world and get a withdrawal in the local currency. And what you'll do is convert that into gold, whatever the price is on that given day, and deduct from my account in gold. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. So that was the next level of innovation. So, you know, if you you know, let's get aside from investment banks and finance for a second. Like the core purpose of a bank, you know, the two ones are savings and payments. And so the savings part, you know, we've done for many years. The original gold money founded by James Turk, you know, really had that part down. What we've added, this next level of fintech and being able to, and also being inspired by some of the use cases of Bitcoin and seeing people willing to transact with commodity money rather than bank system debt money. So it's much more like a barter system, but very well organized on the internet, is now the payments aspect. So we have the gold money MasterCards, including precious metal MasterCards. You can get an 18 karat gold or silver, debit card as well. And so that part makes it very interoperable with obviously all the bank machines and everything else. But also we allow peer-to-peer transfers. So for instance, if I was in Europe, you know, having some beers in the Czech Republic with one of our advisors, and I didn't have any, obviously, you know, Czech krona, and I wanted to settle my bill, I can't really use Venmo or PayPal or these other things, but I can send him $5 worth of gold very quickly from my mobile phone. And we also have merchants that can actually use a business account and invoice, particularly cross-border clients. You know, if I'm a Canadian merchant, I really don't care if I'm getting, you know, British pounds or dollars or anything else, if I'm ultimately wanting to settle the Canadian dollars. So why can't I accept Bitcoin or gold or something else? And it's easier for both the merchant and the person sending it than a very convoluted and expensive banking system. The savings part is still our core business. And I think that's where we have an advantage over the ETFs or any other way to buy gold or silver or precious metals. But also we're innovating on the payments part so we can actually use it as money. And the bigger picture here is this isn't just sort of some gold bug sort of end of the world view that, you know, the knock against gold was always, okay, great. It's a great store of value. But at the end of the world, I can't go buy bread with an ounce of gold. Well, now with the infrastructure we're building, you can. We do. We have clients, you know, that we didn't even know, you know, tweeted us from Nigeria last summer when the Naira was devalued 40%, said, you just saved my savings. And it turns out he was also using it for payments and everything else. So this is a very important infrastructure that we're building, because it's not just for the end of the world. We actually just see that the currency regime of the world is changing. I think that's very objective. And, you know, whether it's Bitcoin and blockchain or new cross-border trade mechanisms, or even the way central banks are managing their currencies, we're moving into a new paradigm, and we're building infrastructure to scale. That's an alternative to, you know, what we think is a very irrational banking system where you've got to pay negative interest rates, but then still deal with all of their settlement problems and all their costs of transactions and missing wires when you send across borders and, you know, infinite background checks to send money. Like, you know, all of that banking system is getting worse, not better. So we're part of this sort of fintech movement that creates market solutions and choice, and building a better commerce system.
And I just want to be clear with our listeners, this is not some idea you're working on. This is something that's here and now today. You can go right now to goldmoney.com, open an account, and they'll very soon send you a credit card that you can, or a debit card perhaps it is, that you can use in order to purchase stuff at the local grocery store in pretty much any country in the world. It will be converted from that local currency to whatever the prevailing price of gold is on that day and debited from your account. So Josh, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Josh. It's amazing to hear some different perspectives on how to look at gold and how to value it, or the different things that influence the price of that gold. What was your takeaway from the interview?
Well, I really enjoy talking to the level-headed gold guys. You know, you hear so many views about gold. This is actually a lesson that Nick Barashev taught me years ago. I was asking him, Nick, what is it about gold that there's just so many conspiracy theories and so much crazy misinformation in the marketplace. And he said, it's simple, Eric. We don't have licenses. The gold guys don't have a license to protect. They're not securities dealers. They don't have to worry about suitability or any of the other rules that govern people that are selling securities. They can tell you anything they want, including crazy stories about central bank conspiracy theories and so forth. So it's good to hear somebody who really can talk about the subject with a level head. The one thing I thought was interesting, though, was the same old subject came up of gold doesn't produce any income. And I remember when I first met you, Patrick, one of the things that you actually specialize in is teaching your clients how to produce income using options or an option writing strategy, essentially using the collateral in your gold position to write options against it. So how is it possible that you actually can produce income if you're holding gold? How do you achieve that? And I know you put a chart together that I think will talk to that.
Well, Eric, you know, when you take a look at gold, it's always been known as this non-producing asset where you're not getting any interest income and it just sits there like a rock. But when you go enhance it with something like option strategies, you're able to open up a whole world of investing where you can create strategies to generate cash flow off of the gold that you hold. And it's just an amazing thing to be able to learn how to do, where you can own this gold. And even when gold is doing nothing and just trading sideways, you're able to create a consistent income stream from it through different strategies such as option writing, covered call writing, or creating spreads on it.
I know a lot of people are using that strategy to enhance income on their stock portfolios. And one of the things I get concerned about is when too many people are doing the same thing, sometimes it stops working. So there's this idea of volatility skew, which, as I understand it, is kind of a measure of how opportune or how effective this strategy is going to be. How does the skew chart for something like the S&P 500 stock index compare with that of gold? Is this a good time to be trying to use an option writing strategy to enhance income? Is it working better on stocks or is it working better on gold right now?
Well, that's a great observation, Eric, because what you've seen is that there's been a growing trend in the broader markets using the S&P 500, using covered call writing as a yield enhancement. And there's a lot of systematic strategies that are there with funds and other things that are using option writing. And as this trend has grown and as this market has become bigger and bigger, it has actually dynamically reshaped the vol skew on the S&P 500. And so it looks like a downward sloping skew, basically always showing that if you go farther out of the money on the covered calls, it's paying you less and less premium. You know, the options market, you still need a buyer for every seller, and it's a process of price discovery. And so it's always a self-correcting thing of supply and demand. And so the more and more people that are looking to sell premium, the options become cheaper and cheaper. But this is not the case in gold. And so what we did was we shared a chart here. And those of our listeners that get the research roundup email, you'll find a link to a chart named the gold volatility skew in your research roundup. And it will show the volatility skew on the January 2018 and 2019 options. And what we see here is, unlike the S&P 500, you have a very healthy U-shape vol skew, which is basically suggesting that someone who is, let's say, buying GLD as an exchange-traded fund can actually get some very healthy income selling out-of-the-money covered calls. And so in this chart, what it's showing here is that as you look on the curve, if you go 10% above on the price of gold, you are actually getting a higher implied volatility payoff than if you were, let's say, buying a put as a protection or selling a put 10% out of the money on the downside. That actually creates a really interesting dynamic on this chart.
So the opportunity is basically you can generate income for gold, which is normally a non-producing asset, by writing options, selling options to somebody else. Now, that means if it goes up by 10% in price, you're going to have to sell that gold. But that might have been something you wanted to do anyway. And this is a way to get paid for doing that.
Absolutely. But the one thing I'd emphasize is that there are traders that trade this. And so if you had a substantial rise in gold and it's approaching the upper strike, you always can actively make the decision to roll up and out or adjust the trade or close it even at a small loss to reopen up the upside of the gold. You're not committed to just letting all your gold get assigned away and you're out of the trade. Nonetheless, when we look at this chart that I added there, you can see that, for Sorensen, selling a January 2018 135 call is paying just around 80 cents, while the, let's say, 109 put option on the GLD is only bidding 35 to 40 cents. And you can really see the shape of that skew makes the call actually have a pretty compelling income on a comparative basis.
Okay, got it. So that's one way to enhance income from a gold position. Let's go back to a subject that we first talked about a couple of weeks ago that we've been meaning to work into our post game, which is various tactics and strategies for trading the U.S. dollar. Now, when we talked to Raul Paul and Julian Brigden, they thought maybe the low, the bottom was almost in. It's done nothing but bounce up from there. So far, it appears they may be right. On the other hand, when we talked to Juliet de Klerk, she was expecting a bounce like we're seeing now. She thought it was an opportunity to short the dollar. So let's cover both of those. If you wanted to take a long or a short view on the dollar, how might you approach it from a trading standpoint?
Yeah, well, my takeaway from that interview that we had was that we are pretty much at a key pivot in the U.S. dollar, and particularly the U.S. dollar index may not be the best vehicle to trade considering its euro-heavy influence. So I wanted to discuss some of the best methods that you can do in trading currencies for non-institutional traders. Now, traditionally, most people would approach currencies through simply Forex or now a growing trend of having Forex options. And while that is always an acceptable way to trade currency, one of the downfalls is a lot of these firms are poorly regulated, located all over the world, and don't have a lot of transparency. That allows a lot of traders then to turn to the futures markets as one of the ways to get exposure to a currency. And so when you go to the CME Globex, they have all the majors out there as futures contracts. And the best part is they actually have options on those futures contracts. And I really like this market. It has a great exchange transparency. It has a very attractive leverage. I would say the disadvantage for a beginner, of course, though, is knowing the different multipliers for those futures contract. For instance, a euro futures contract is going to have 125,000 multiplier, while a Canadian dollar futures contract is going to have 100,000 multiplier, and the yen will have 12,500,000 multiplier. So it's back of the napkin math, but you just have to take that extra step of knowing what the multiplier is when you're calculating not only how much currency you're controlling, but also the multiplier for the options themselves. And that brings the third thing that I wanted to talk about, which is this a newer product where they created the Guggenheim Currency Share Trusts, where they actually have like exchange traded funds, these currency trusts trading on the actual exchanges. These are also very transparent. The disadvantage, though, is that they offer substantially less margin. Well, and sometimes for the beginner, that's probably a good thing because leverage can be a double-edged sword that can make you a lot of money, but can also create a lot of losses when you're on the wrong side of the trade. But what's interesting about that is they also have a pretty interesting options market on many of those. They also have a pretty good options market on many of those trust shares. And so this translates to a scenario where if you want the leverage, you're going to turn to the futures market. But if you don't have access to the futures markets, you can actually use these currency shares as a very viable way to trade the markets. I think the biggest observation is when you're doing something like, let's say, a short option strategy, let's say naked calls or naked puts, you literally are required to, in some cases, have as much as 10 times the amount of margin on these currency share options than you would on the options on the futures contracts.
Patrick, let's bring this down to brass tacks with an example so we can illustrate how this would actually be done, both using futures or with the exchange-traded trust approach. Let's suppose, going back to that interview with Raul Paul and Julian Brigden, that you wanted to follow the narrative that commodity-driven currencies in developed markets are likely to weaken against the U.S. dollar. So let's take the Canadian dollar for an example. How would you put the trade on with futures? How would you put the trade on with the exchange-traded trust product?
Good question. Let's do that comparison. So let's say we're talking about one of these futures contracts that trade on the Globex for the Canadian dollar. Each one of those futures contracts today is controlling about $78,000 of currency, long or short, depending on whether you're buying or selling the futures contract. So if you today were to take one contract of, let's say, the at-the-money December, let's say 70.5 cent put option, it's now trading around 1 cent. With the 100,000 multiplier, that's costing about $1,000 to control that one option. Now, alternatively, for the FXC, which is the exchange-traded fund units, the one share is trading around $78. So 1,000 shares of the FXC are controlling about the same $78,000 as the futures contract. So in order to control 1,000 shares, you'd have to buy 10 put options, let's say in this case, the December 77 puts that are trading around $1 a share. So that would also cost about $1,000. So you can see that whether you bought the one put option on the futures contract or whether you bought 10 put options on the FXC, they would both roughly cost the same. And that's about right, because otherwise, if they weren't trading very similar, they would create an opportunity for arbitrage. And so you're going to get actually a very similar outcome. Of course, the biggest difference here is that you would really need a futures trading account to be able to do the futures options, while the FXC options can be pretty much done in almost every traditional trading account. And I think that's when you're talking about a retail listener, that's a very accessible product for them.
Well, I think it's also important to stress that the sizes are so different. Futures are all big. Just one futures contract is $78,000, whereas you can, as you said, do one-tenth of that with an option on the exchange-traded product. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time, folks. For those of you who are interested in learning more about this, Patrick is in the business of teaching people to trade. There's no better teacher out there than Patrick. So if you're interested in learning more, be sure to visit bigpicturetrading.com, where you can learn about the various courses offerings that Patrick has on offer. Meanwhile, we still need your help promoting the show. So please retweet us when we announce the show. A retweet is better than a like. You guys, a lot of us are liking and not too many retweeting. Tell your friends about it. Forward your research roundups. Use the donate button if you're able to donate and help us defray our operating costs. Use our player embed in order to put a Macro Voices player on your favorite website. But most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. The more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best feature interview guests for our feature interviews every single week. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email every week. It never contains advertising or marketing, just links to all the coolest free stuff that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Josh Crum. There's also that link to that chart we talked about in terms of the gold volatility skew. There's also a blog article written by Kevin Muir titled "That Billionaire's Bear Club," and also an interesting article from Jeffrey Snyder titled "Data Dependent Interest Rates Have Nowhere to Go." You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.